when you look into the past and really start to understand it and understand things like, you know, an ancient multi-ethnic culture that didn't follow any of the confines of the ideas of race that we have now. Like, how does that change the way you think about race now? How does that thing change the way you think about culture and identity and whether you can make change? I mean, that's like, that's what I would love to communicate.
Hey everybody, sorry I've been a little bit silent in the feed for a while, but you're also living in the same world as I am, so I'm sure you can understand and forgive me. About that, and about the topic of today's episode, today we're talking about exploration, but as a part of that we're talking about history. And I know for myself, and maybe for some of you as well, it feels like this present moment is a type of history lesson. Partly, I mean a lesson in specific elements of history, the history of policing, the history of the Spanish flu. These are all things that we're all learning about right now as much as we possibly can. But more than that, I have a sense that the present moment is a lesson to many of us alive about history, in all caps. I've said this many times in my intros, but each day I'm alive, it's more and more clear that history is not over. What I mean is, there's this sense I have, and maybe you've had it too, that whatever important event, the Cold War, the Emancipation Proclamation, the death of Caesar, whatever, these were all things that happened, and yes, butterfly effect, if they hadn't happened, then this present moment would be different, and so on and so forth. But we're not still dealing with their ramifications. They're over. They're done. This current moment, however, what we're all living through, the pandemic, the massive civil rights protests, the terrible leadership, these all make it blindingly clear just how much we live in a contiguous moment, still connected to all things past. The slave patrols of the South, for instance, aren't some buried bedrock we've built our house on. They're the river that carries our boat. Same with the Soviet and Western propaganda brinksmanship, American colonialism, the Industrial Revolution. Pretty much everything that's happened is something that is still happening. These aren't things we live on top of. They're not settled issues, as much as it might feel like it. And they're things that people like myself have been foolish to think we're only prologue. Now, I say this because my guest today is an explorer who spends his time, when he's not quarantined, unearthing the burial mounds of a nearly forgotten steppe people who some people in the far right are trying to reconstruct as a sort of proto-Aryan hero. Through his lens as an explorer, we discuss what history can look like when you're looking through different lenses, and how you need to be careful who you're letting tell you the story of the past. This is all to say, it's important that we not only learn our history, but learn how we're learning our history. We also talk about exploration in this, and how staying curious and engaged and excited is so important. And it's important for the beautiful things, it's important for discovering cool ancient peoples, but it's also important for moments like this. For moments when the entire world seems to have its veil ripped down, it's important to stay an explorer and try to find out what pieces have held this house together that you've never looked at. I know for me, this has been a moment of doing that every day. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoy this conversation because I really enjoyed having it. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to At Least There's This, a show about some of the small good things in our, in 2020, I guess. I used to say a world of hurt, but that's just the year that we're living in. So I am recording this probably not the week that I'll be dropping it, but this is week three of the massive protests that have gripped the country. I've been out in the street as much as I can be, but I'm back right now to talk to some people. And I don't know, I don't really have anything glib or funny to say because I don't think that there's anything glib or funny to say about this moment. We are all living through a massive wake-up call, a groundswell, and a time where we need to listen to the voices of the people who have been oppressed for a really long time, and it's great that people are doing that, but there's a lot of pushback in the world and also just a lot of pain. But in a world where there's tons and tons of pain, not just from this, but from a pandemic and from waking up every day in a world that is tough, at least there's
exploration.
Guys, I am with someone who I am so excited to be talking with. I am with old friend, explorer, documentary filmmaker, Trevor Wallace. Hi, Trevor.
How's it going, Alex? Great to talk to you, man.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, too. So you are an explorer, and we're going to talk about a lot of what you do in a second, but real quick, like, what does that mean in 2020?
Yeah, so it's an interesting process on reflecting what an explorer means. I think, like, the title of an explorer is, I think, one of the better analogies is, like, an artist. Like, lots of people define it in different ways. I've also heard people say, like, all exploration is adventure, but not all adventure is exploration. And I think that really shows that, you know, exploration is not really, you know, from the standpoint of the Explorers Club, where I'm the VP for research, it's not really physical feats. It's not really, you know, climbing a mount on top of a mountain to conquer it. It's not really even like rowing across an ocean or doing things that really kind of show how you have bested nature. That is a kind of a tired, you know, mid-19th century version of an explorer. And I think that even looking farther back in history, it's really important to problematize what do we mean with explorer. I think especially, you know, in the perspective of recent events, you know, I'm in Boston and they just tore off the head of the statue of Columbus. And I wish I was there. I would have done it myself. I think he was a horrible criminal. And unfortunately, he leaves the legacy of being one of these historic explorers. But that doesn't mean that, you know, as part of the Explorers Club or as part of a community, that we all identify with these explorers. You know, during the, they call it the golden age of exploration, about 500 years ago, when you had these, you know, really what was the impetus was the transatlantic slave trade, colonialism. These explorers were basically a part of the colonial apparatus. And instead of bringing knowledge back, which, you know, I'll get to later and how we kind of define it nowadays in terms of science and field research, they were bringing back resources. They were exploiting the peoples that they traveled to. And then they were kind of, you know, what they brought back was a treasure of a physical kind. Whereas what we bring back nowadays, and actually in the past as well, is knowledge. Because I think that sometimes people think, oh, every explorer of this, you know, ancient or older times, even going back to medieval times, was bad. There's ones like, you know, for example, Ibn al-Battuta was this Moroccan cleric who traveled super far and recorded, you know, things in Russia and Indonesia, and this was in the 1300s, and wow, he was not, you know, raping and pillaging. So there are good examples as well. But yeah, that is a long story short that the term and the title explorer is definitely a complicated one and necessary to unpack.
I'm excited to get into unpacking that, because as I was saying before we started rolling, I spend most of my time now talking to scientists, which is a different kind, well, not necessarily a different kind of knowledge gathering, but it's also been a role that, in light of recent history, is one that people have needed to unpack and say, okay, how have we been complicit in certain how have we been complicit in certain, like, certain racial apparatuses, and what is our role in knowledge gathering, and like, how can those two things be separated? And it's been a really enlightening conversation to watch the whole world having right now. But before we get into anything like that, I want to know more about you. Would you describe yourself as an optimist or a pessimist?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think I would say, in terms of life strategy, definitely an optimist. I think from observation, it is the winning strategy. I think thinking about that question, not to get overly philosophical, but I think, like,
no, that's the point of the show, dude. Oh. Overly philosophical as you want. Well, we're freshmen in college smoking a joint right now. So,
nice. I'm right there with you. About to take that big hit. So yeah. So I think it's like, if you're gonna ascribe to being an optimist or a pessimist, I think you have to have some order in your worldview, and I think I at least fall into like there not really being any one kind of world order to ascribe to. I think it's all socially constructed. I think our culture, I think especially the work that I do that is, you know, mostly in archaeology, looking at ancient cultures that lived very, very different lives. I think one of the fascinating things is understanding, you know, how much of this we've just made up, even these concepts of optimists and pessimists. And in the current culture society we live in, I think it's 100% the right idea to be an optimist. But do I think it's like this, you know, big T truth? I don't know.
I love that sort of like, you exist in a world where there's no solid grounding to be one way or the other. I've heard certain people I've had on the show will try to use the word nihilism to describe that sentiment. I don't necessarily cop to that being nihilism. I think that sort of that misses the mark, but I think that's what they're trying to describe when they're saying that, is that like, well, it's all grounded in humans anyway.
Yeah. We've made up this entire fantasy, so it's just like choosing the reality you want to live in. And of course there's like hard constraints on that reality, and like, you know, and you kind of fall into that relativist abyss of like, you know, this is, none of this is real, but like,
right.
But I think in terms of like choosing, you talk about ethics, you talk about just good and evil, a lot of times it's just much more simple to say, yes, I'm an optimist. Short answer, yes, I'm an optimist.
Can you give me an example of maybe something from one of these cultures that you study that really puts into stark contrast how much this is human construct, like how different their worldview was while not being groundless and wrong?
Yeah, it's interesting. So like, you watch a lot of, you know, whether it's the old Nova, PBS, or even Nat Geo shows, there's this common trope of archaeology media where at some point they say, you know, when we dig up these burials or when we come across these things, you really realize how similar these ancient people were to us. Like, they're really not all that different. But in my experience, what I found is that the more you find out about their culture and the context of their burials and, you know, the little pieces of information you can glean, is that they were really different. And that's what makes it exciting, is that they were like vastly, wildly different cultures that they constructed around things that we can like barely wrap our heads around. But to me, that's much cooler. The fact that they lived completely different lives. And like, especially now when we're thinking about massive social change and we think about, you know, things that have been ingrained for, you know, hundreds of years. Can we change? Can we do things like defund the police? Like, this whole idea of police was completely made up.
Right.
And
I've been thinking about that like all week, how people are like, we can't not have the police. And like, yeah, well, 300 years ago, that idea didn't exist. So yeah, why can't they didn't have it? Like, why could we not just conceivably not have it? It's yeah, possible.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's like, that's the archaeologist's lens, that's the historian's lens. When you look back in time, in my opinion, like the tombs that I've been excavating over the past few years are these nomadic Siberian horse lords called the Scythians. And they just don't fit into the common canon of the history of antiquity. They were like horseback warrior archers, nomadic peoples that lived during the Iron Age, so about 1,000 years before Christ, just for a sort of context. And they just don't fit well into our sequence of how societies and cultures develop. This sort of, you know, Eurocentric view that, you know, once you're hunter gatherers, once you find agriculture, you start to, you know, build cities and you grow from there. Whereas the Scythians were these mix of different ethnicities. They came over from, you know, Indo-Europe, but they kind of came over and mixed and made it very far east. And they had some early forms of agriculture, but they were like, screw agriculture. Like, I don't want to till fields. Like, this is terrible. Like, you know, you need massive amounts of labor. You know, one bad winter can take out your whole crop. Why not, let's have, you know, horses and sheep and goats, and we can just bring our food and our clothes along with us. And they built this culture where they built massive burial mounds that were, you know, probably took thousands of people to build. They had incredibly complex art. They had this society that we don't really understand, but from the archaeological context, you can tell this was incredibly sophisticated. But they didn't have the written word. They had no cities, so they don't really, like, it's hard to grok them in a way. And I think that's, for me, is like, looking back, when you see these ancient cultures, they just had, like, especially when you find, for example, ice mummies, when you find the frozen organic remains, you can get this view into their daily life that is just, you know, their customs, their habits, their day-to-day life. When you think about their forms of social control or ethics, you know, good and evil, was just totally different. And for me, that's exciting. It doesn't, like, distance me from them.
That's one of my favorite things about people like you and people involved in any knowledge gathering at all, is that when done sort of in a poor colonial lens, it props up structures, but when done well, it's this very full frontal, like, fuck you to what you think the world must be. What we walk around with these assumptions on, this is how the world must be, right? This is how culture must be. And oftentimes good history or good science is, no, it's not like that. It doesn't have to be like that at all, which is something that, I mean, right now, I don't know if you're on Twitter or not, but with with the anti-racist movement, a lot of people have been calling out the History Channel for Ancient Aliens, which is one of my least favorite things in the world. Like, I've lost friends over that program.
Oh, yeah.
And that whole mythos is like, well, culture is one certain way, and so we see these old things and they must relate to our culture the way that, like, we expect them to. This is a spaceship, obviously. And it's like, well, then you're looking at it through your cultural lens instead of allowing your lens to expand, which is what I think explorers like you do. You expand lenses.
Yeah, man. Just like, oh, damn, where do I start about Ancient Aliens? Like, it's just
wherever you want.
It is such racial gaslighting, just horrible, horrible, baseless science. I mean, the dude with the big hair, I've been invited to like be sort of an expert on Ancient Aliens. I flat out refuse. I've actually met someone recently who is the lawyer of that guy and says he's awful. He treats the entire crew like shit. It's actually no surprise that he's a terrible person, because when you think about what they, you know, what they put out on their show, is this really Eurocentric view that if it didn't happen in ancient Greece or Rome, it had to have been aliens. Like, basically these people in the global south elsewhere, whether it's Maya or the pyramids or whatever, you know, the pyramids in Egypt or, you know, Timbuktu, the massive mosques built there, it's like they find some way to make it aliens. And it's a very, very colonial and racist way of explaining how these things could have been done. So, yeah, I have a bone to pick. Like, when they have, like, some of those, like, YouTuber boxing matches, like, I wish there was an equivalent for people working in archaeology and media that I could just, glove up
bring
and
out your dude. Yeah, go to town. Well, let's instead of dwelling on the bad, I mean, the reason that I brought that up is to talk about the importance and the power of exploration to be a widening of our lenses.
Yeah.
So I think I'd rather move us there. And let's start from the beginning. How did you become an explorer?
Yeah, so I think, like, early on, it was really my mom who wanted to give me opportunities to have experiential learning. Like, exploration is curiosity in action. I think that's a quote from, like, John Glenn or something. But it is really taking that those ideas of wonder and just taking them out there into the world. You know, maybe it starts with books and it starts with magazines. And, you know, I grew up with the single mom who was disabled. And it really, you know, sort of family vacations to exotic places weren't in the books for me. But she found some really incredible organizations that I was lucky to get scholarships with. One of them is called Students on Ice, which sounds like some ice skating Disney type thing. But it's actually a fantastic organization that's based out of Canada. and they bring kids from all around the world to the Arctic and the Antarctic. And I was able to go to the Antarctic and just meet kids from Arctic Canada. I was able to meet kids from Polynesia, and we were able to have these discourses about climate change, about culture, about what we were experiencing, about science. And I was 18 at that point. I had already had a couple other opportunities through an organization called Where There Be Dragons that also gives scholarships, and there's a lot of them out there that, it took a lot of tries, but eventually I was able to kind of reflect on these experiences, write, get grants, get scholarships, and get into that world where I was storytelling, where I was collaborating with scientists, historians. And that ultimately led me to the Explorers Club, which is in New York City. It's a 116-year-old organization that is housed in this old Tudor mansion and kind of has the old mahogany feel that you would imagine it'd be. And its members were the first to the top of Mount Everest, the first to the bottom of Marianas Trench, the North, the South Pole. All of the Apollo missions had Explorers Club flags with them. So it really has this history of membership that has a lot of legacy to it. And that's where they host Monday night lectures. And when I was at Sarah Lawrence with you, I would sometimes like go down to the city and go to some of these lectures. And that's where I started meeting archaeologists and applying for these small grants to do fieldwork projects.
So what was the feeling you got at these lectures or out on the projects or even in like talking with the other people who were involved in some of these exploration grants you were a part of? What did it feel like that then made you want so much more of it?
Yeah, there's this kind of the Explorers Club has this vibe of kind of romantic, like a romantic view of it. Like many of the people that you meet are scientists there. Like I think of one of the, because now I actually run the grants program at the Explorers Club, so I have the really amazing experience of being able to meet all the different grantees. Like one of our grantees, my Fami, who's a postdoc at Fordham, she does research on leeches in Madagascar. And she's so hard into the science, into the hard science of it. But when you step into these sort of hallowed halls, you also share this romantic sense of adventure that you don't always get in other science, in a scientific conference, in other spaces. You don't feel that sense of adventure and that sense of history that's there. And I mean the feeling of the place also, like a lot of there's a lot of taxidermy there that's old, and it comes from like Teddy Roosevelt shot a lot of the animals that you like see around, which for some people, and rightly so, is sort of disturbing. But that said, it kind of has a feeling of like the Museum of Natural History. These were specimens that were like collected, so to speak, when scientific study was really based on taxidermy there. It had like a very close relationship. So it does, it like for me, it does have this feeling of Indiana Jones and Tintin and these things that I have like a childhood love of, but have also come to be highly critical of. And I think it's like that's why I wanted to get more involved with the Explorers Club, is that it kind of has this mysterious, backroom feel to it. But there's so much room for kind of reinventing what an explorer is in the 21st century. There are members like, there are members like Teddy Roosevelt, who in himself was like highly problematic. He did things that were contradictory. Like he both established national parks through the Antiquities Act, and he also like killed the like one like some of the last remaining rhinos in Belt. I think it was like they wouldn't let him shoot a certain type of rhino in the Belgian Congo, so he went to the British. Like really messed up view of things. But then you also have members like Jane Goodall, Sylvia Earle, and even historic members like a lot of people don't know. Likely the first person to stand on the North Pole was an African American explorer named Matthew Henson, who went with Admiral Peary on that first expedition in 1909. So I like the Explorers Club because it isn't a simple place. It's got a lot of issues in some ways that need to be dealt with in terms of race and memory and equity. But it also has this feeling of adventure that you just don't find elsewhere.
And that feeling of adventure and exploration, like, why does it feel good, right? Are you about to learn something new? Are you excited to learn something new? Or, like, what's that driving force?
Yeah, so I think for me, it was really this feeling that the whole world has already been mapped. Everything is known. You know, we have, like, detailed satellite data of the entire planet. You look something up, there's already, like, a multiple-sided Wikipedia article. Every archaeological site is already UNESCO World Heritage Site. But you go to the Explorers Club, and this has happened when I met my project partner, Gino Caspari. So he started telling me about these Scythian tombs, and I had never heard of the Scythians. And he started talking about Xinjiang and Tuva and these parts that even for me, like, I was a geography teacher for middle schoolers. Like, these were parts of my map that were, like, off the edge. And he was like, there are undocumented tombs out there. There are things that are still not known to science. There are still things left to discover. And in fact, the things that we kind of put up on this pedestal of, like, first on the top of Mount Everest, like, that is not as significant as uncovering the origin of a culture in many ways in terms of what it does for humanity, especially what it does for me in terms of curiosity and what it in terms of, like, our human contribution of why we go out into the field. And that it takes this, like, still there is a feeling of rugged field work. Like, our site is in a swamp in Siberia. Like, there's no roads out there. Like, it's kind of like there are no laws. There's nowhere coming to get you. Like,
I remember reading an Instagram post by you about carrying, like, what, 30 kilograms of water, or how much water was it?
It was like, yeah, we had these massive tanks that would usually bring our resupplies to the actual tomb, because it's like a waist deep swamp that floods throughout the summer, and the tanks broke, and I happened to be, like, in our camp, and there was this big 30-liter jug that I had to carry to the site. And honestly, like, actually looking at it, I was like, oh, it's not going to be so bad. Like, that was an experience that just rocked me. And it was such, like, a basic thing. Like, in a lot of archaeological digs, like, if you're doing a Roman dig, you know, in Italy, you could be living in a villa and, like, eating really good food. In our circumstance, we're off the grid, and you find circumstances where it's like you have 60 of your friends who've been working all day in the hot sun, and they don't have a drop of water, and it's on you to carry them water, or, like, people are going to get extremely dehydrated. And, like, we had people who ended up having to go to the hospital with kidney stones, and, like, you just, it's really difficult work. And that was all going through my head as I was, like, carrying the super heavy water on this kind of, like, improvised metal frame that was, like, digging into my back and cutting into my back, and it was sort of, like, leaking out one side, and so, like, I'd fall, and then it would, like, all the water would switch to one side, and I would, like, fall even harder, and I, like, couldn't let the water from the swamp get in because it was, like, Giardia infested. But, like, it took me an hour and a half, and I eventually made it, and it was just, like, one of those, like, mental things where it's, like, ironic because we use all this insane technology like 3D modeling and photogrammetry and geophysics to understand our tomb, and we have that out there. And then on the other hand, it's like super low tech, like some dude had to carry the water to the site. Like,
so what draws you to that? Because you could be in one of these, like, villas drinking espresso and then going out and doing a Roman dig site, but you choose to be in, well, this is Siberia, right?
Yeah,
you choose to be in Siberia.
Yeah, I mean, it has, like, it kind of combines those two things that I love. It is the romantic adventure of it, but it's also the unknown aspect. Like, we know so much about Roman amphoras. There are, like, hundreds and hundreds, and there are definitely specific research questions that are important about, you know, Greek or Roman or what have you. But there's basically no data on the tomb we're excavating. It's the oldest Scythian tomb ever found. So it's the origin of this culture. Every data point that we find is rewriting history. And there's no coincidence that it's out in the middle of Siberia and that no one has found it, documented it at all. So like, to me, that's what makes it exciting, is that, like, yeah, even though you're like covered in mosquitoes and mud, and we even dug into Siberian winter into November, where we were like risking frostbite and like
Fuck.
really messed up situation, to get this data from the ground, which is really new knowledge and like big questions, like not like, oh, how much, wine were they? And I don't mean to like totally just
Shit
demean,
on Roman archaeology.
but like just the scope of the research questions when, and it really is entrenched in academia, the way that like classics and classical archaeology is super well funded, and for the foreseeable future it will. Like, if you go into classics archaeology, there are jobs where you could have a job. It's super risky to go into something like Central Asian archaeology, where there are not that many departments. You usually have to learn another language. You have to go to places that are inhospitable. Like, there are not many routes within like a career or a real job where you can make it. So for me, that was like, do I want to get my PhD and try to write a thesis and become a professor, or do I want to try to share some of this story through film to a broader public who's curious about ancient warrior nomads? And maybe this will spur more funding. Maybe this will spur more focus on the blank spots in the map, or rather than the blank spots, the spots that just haven't gotten the attention that they deserve.
Haven't gotten the fill, like the deep level of cross shading that all the other spots have gotten.
Yeah.
How would you feel if there was nothing left?
It's really boring. I mean, I don't really get bored, but yeah, I sometimes feel this way when, at the Explorers Club, you find some people who are like, they're trying to be the first person to row across the Atlantic in a boat shaped like this while do it. Like, it's splitting hairs to get that first, to be like,
Right.
and it that's the feeling you get, where it's like, is there any point to it? Like, there's really no point. Like, you might as well just be like a, Insta traveler and travel around to take a selfie in a cool place. But it's
Yeah.
like exploration. Like, that's always felt like for travel for me was has always been connected to projects. Like, it's kind of sad. I'm not really very good at being a tourist. Like, I mostly end up in museums or like trying to find out if people had done archaeology in the place. But it's interesting because sometimes people ask me about like travel tips, and even though I've like traveled to seven continents and probably 45 countries, I have very few good travel tips that give. And not that there's anything wrong with that. Like, I like traveling for pleasure is something I want to find more about because I think it can be very personally rewarding. But yeah.
This sounds like we're talking around the idea of meaning, right? And this
Yeah.
goes back to the first thing we talked about being an optimist versus a pessimist, and that, like, well, it doesn't really mean anything because this is all human developed. And so it sounds like what we're talking about is how to live a life meaningfully. And what it is about peering into the unknown that brings meaning to not just your life, but life in general. Am I touching on anything like
Yeah.
that feel true? Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's like when you think about things left to discover, like human history in particular, and that's why, like, there's so many areas of exploration, whether it's field science that's looking into conservation biology. Obviously, this week is Oceans Week at the Explorers Club, so you have all kinds of people, talking about conservation solutions, sustainability. For me, the fascinating thing about the human story and the human past is that the human fabric is limitless. Like, we go back hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. And like, there's so many unanswered questions. Like, kind of the deeper you dig, the more questions you have. So it's almost like this, yeah, it feels like this infinite source of inspiration that maybe in other cases doesn't feel quite as much.
Everything you touch on then branches into another. It's fractaline, right? Everything
Yeah.
you touch becomes something else. I have this image when I talk to my friends who are working scientists, and then I'm getting it talking to you too, but it's like it's these people who are shoving their face into the ontology bubble, right? Like, as far into the edge of what is known and knowable as possible, just trying to get that little bit, right? What else can I see? What else can I find? And I find when I talk to people like you, like these scientists who I spend a lot of time with, or artists in many cases, that like refusal to stop looking is what provides life with so much meaning, because meaning does feel, I don't know, manufactured in a way. So you have to manufacture it in a way that's meaningful. Well, that's tautologist, but you have to manufacture it in a way that brings something to you. Would you say finding things that haven't been known and like filling in that picture a little bit more, like that gives you a greater sense of worth and time well spent than anything else you could be doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely depends on what you're looking at, and that's what draws me to some of like the bigger questions within archaeology, with, you know, in Central Asian archaeology, the movements of people, you know, even this idea of an interesting thing is the way we look back on history has so much to do with modern politics and identity. A fascinating thing when I was doing research on, you know, and doing this media project about the Scythians have been co-opted by the right in this bizarre way. So yeah, oh yeah. So you have these ultra right wing guys who see them as sort of Indo-Europeans that made it very, very far east. And you see a lot of strange, and this getting into like ancient aliens territory where, you know, even in like a little bit south in China, you have the Taklamakan mummies, which were mummies that had sometimes blonde hair, sometimes red hair. And these were Eurasian peoples that, you know, to them look European. And you actually find some of the pseudoscience out there that they were like Celtic because they had things that looked like tartans. But it's a way that like basically pop science and ancient aliens types have found one researcher who compared the textile to tartans and then said, oh, these are Celtic peoples, when they were clearly not. And the fascinating thing is that when you actually get into the true science of it, that the Scythians, and the Scythians, like just for a little background knowledge, like that was an ethnonym from the Greeks. Like they did not call themselves the Scythians. We don't actually know what they called themselves. We have inklings of what language they spoke. They were a fluid nomadic, group of people that stretched from Siberia to the Black Sea that had a very consistent material culture, artistic style. I mean, they had like in the frozen mummies, they were covered in these tattoos. And you have like this very like iconic animal style art. But in the actual burials, you have people who, you know, from our modern interpretations of ethnicity would be Asian next to Indo-Europeans buried together. Like their idea of ethnicity and race probably had nothing to do with what we conceive of it today. And you find these like fascist right-wing types saying that, oh, these were the Europeans in Asia, the strong Scythian warriors, when really this was probably one of the earliest like multi-ethnic societies. Like it actually totally disproves what they're saying on these bizarre like online forums.
Yeah, I love that. That goes back to what we were saying a few minutes ago, that when you look at history and you look at science, it tells you have to throw out your interpretation of the world how you think it ought to be. I remember the first time reading about the Mongols and how like multicultural that culture was, and like, oh well, this was not at all what I thought going into this. Like I thought that, you know, I thought that the worlds barely knew each other. I thought that West and East never really like communicated. And no, it was a very fluid culture. And I think that is oftentimes a world expanding mindset. And it's an important thing that people like you do if people listen, which is the hard part, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think fortunately with like an ancient culture like the Scythians, they are so charismatic and there's so many tie-ins to our like basic modern culture. Like essentially the myth of the Amazons was based on Scythian women. So Herodotus wrote a whole book about these barbarian nomads on the edge of the map for them. So like the guy they call the father of history, also called the father of lies. like basically this first ethnographer, like he based his whole idea of the other, this non-understandable people, which really shapes our study of anthropology and history ever since, because, you know, it really goes back to the Greeks, was on the Scythians and how they didn't understand them, their burial rites, why women were riding horses and shooting arrows from horseback and were these strong women warriors. And, you know, he even describes them making these vapor baths with weed in them. And we found in the archaeological record cannabis seeds in frozen tombs. And we found women with traces in their bones of riding horses and buried with weapons. So there's...
So the Scythians fucking rule is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, without a doubt.
They rode horses and shit, yeah.
Oh, and there's this whole saying of, like, getting drunk as a Scythian. Like, Greeks would say that. And they use Scythians as, like, their bodyguards and their... They would train their prince's archery. And they would just get, you know... crazy drunk and you know, they would do these like blood rites with cannabis, and they made no sense to the ancient Greeks, who were their contemporaries, but they had like a vastly different culture that was feared and respected and highly complex as well. Like, you look at one of these burials that's in the same valley that we're excavating in, and one of the rulers had pants made entirely of gold, thousands and thousands of tiny beads. And I've been able to hold some of these tiny gold beads. They haven't been able to recreate them by modern craftsmen. It's impossible. And you imagine a guy riding out on horseback with like solid gold shining pants. Like, these are not nomads in Siberia eking out an existence. This was like just something we barely can wrap our heads around.
It's like, oh, Ancient Aliens misses the point. Like, these people, yeah, they are from here. They're from Earth, and they are as alien to us as anything we can imagine. What's the coolest thing you've learned in this exploration, in this project?
Yeah, I mean, just to riff quickly off that is, like, and I think it relates to the answer to the question, is, like, the difference is amazing. That we shouldn't, like... recently I was working on the Explorers Club application for some of our grants and how we collect demographic information about how to make it as equitable and inclusive as possible, and how we need to collect data. And, you know, there was some, you know, dare I say, older generation folks are saying we need to be, you know, aren't we colorblind? And we say, no, like, we want to acknowledge and accept and understand difference, because that's what makes our club amazing. That's what makes our collaborations amazing. That's what makes our teams amazing. That's what makes life interesting and worth living. That there are different cultures in our modern world, and there are many different varied cultures in our ancient world. And, like, that's how I approach it. And so when I find things that, like, man, like, some of the things that I've learned that get me really excited, I mean, a lot along the lines of what's come from these permafrost tombs. I mean, just the tattoos are just entrancing, of these animals entwined in battle and these kind of transforming mythological beasts, are really incredible. I mean, and I think alongside that, like, we've had a shaman bless our dig. Every time we excavate, we ask the ancestors for permission to dig, and there's no guarantee we're going to get permission. And this is very important because we work on a team with local Tuvinians, collaborators, team members who work with us. And this process of the shaman blessing our dig is really a communication with the ancient dead, which may seem at odds with, like, the hard science that we're doing. But to me, it's not. And it's not even, like, just a show to show that we have this local sort of support or whatever. Like, I think it's incredibly important because we're working with human remains. Like, I've worked with human bones. Like, when you open a grave that is in situ, when it's lit, you see the bones laid in the way they were, you know, over 2,000 years ago. We found one that was an adult holding a young child. Wow. And you could still see the bones laid in that way. And it was just sort of like I get chills just thinking about it. And, you know, so many archaeological contexts are looted And so that's why in a lot of ways, it's a race against time because, you know, desperate people and a lot of times trying economic situations, they end up digging up these tombs because many of them are easy to find or locally known. And these artifacts end up in museums and auction houses. And, you know, unfortunately, what you see is like, you know, poor marginalized people in remote areas cannibalizing their own culture and then rich people in the West benefiting economically. So we feel real pressure to excavate and document these tombs with the local support that we have. And you really feel that power when you see the shaman making offerings to the fire. A lot of the Tuvinian animist beliefs have to do with fire, have to do with elemental spirits. And the chants and the ceremony that usually lasts about 45 minutes is a communication with these ancestors. And I've been lucky enough to observe like four or five of these different shaman blessing ceremonies, and each one is different. So that's something that like really is interesting to me and is really exciting for me. Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's interesting is like, in kind of riffing off that, is a lot of people say like, who are the descendants of the Scythians? And you find a lot of these groups who try to find out the specific DNA or whatever that comes from them. But really, like, when you go back, and people think ancient peoples were these like pure genealogy that like you can trace to now, but it really is not. And what I love about archaeology is it shows what material culture, like the things that bond us that are not through blood and genetics, the culture that's built, the society that's built, is really so much more important. Because you can find people who have a similar genetic code, so to speak, that you find in the burials, but their life way is nothing like it. And modern day Tuvinians, in many cases, are not genetically related to the Scythian burials that we find. They're different. They came from the south, later from Xiongnu Empire, and just have different genetic strains there. But they are much, much closer and have a much deeper understanding of the life ways of the Scythians. I mean, they're like little pieces that you find that in the archaeological record that match things that are still done today. You know, the way that cattle are slaughtered are through this like one kind of puncture hole in the skull. That the ancient Scythians did with the war pick, a chikan, and that's how they do it today in Tuva. And all you have to do is watch a Tuvinian ride to know this was coming from, you know, Scythian heritage. This is Scythian material culture, Scythian life ways that was just that region, that part of the steppe. So you might have somebody in you know, northern Iran who might have a similar, you know, genes to Scythian burial, but the modern, you have like people who are, because we try to talk about who are the descendants, and I think it's oftentimes a big question of people, who are the descendants? And in all of our opinion, the true descendants are the people who continue the life ways of nomadic peoples. And you see nomadic peoples all around the world, like with globalization, it's more and more difficult to keep these nomadic ways. And, you know, when we visit nomadic families, I personally, as a media person, storyteller, I try not to like exoticize them. And I try to include the fact they have like a solar panel on the side of their yurt and they have like a cell phone and a car in some place. But then you also see they have knowledge of the land and their animals. And, you know, riding horses and surviving in Siberia where the climate is super harsh that you don't have, which I find fascinating, that these are modern people, but you can see the connections that they have to the past that many of us lack.
Has this changed how you want to live your life day to day, being both so up close with modern nomadic peoples, but also with the cultures that you're excavating?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic because the lives of archaeologists, especially the archaeological team that we work with, which is like a core group of maybe 20 or 30 people, you end up like almost imitating the transient life of ancient nomads, because really, they weren't, you know, in most cases, and with modern nomads as well, they weren't really moving constantly. They had like a winter camp and a summer camp, and there was this kind of migration. And we kind of see all these common threads in our lives where we're living 4 or 5, sometimes 6 months out in the field, living in a tent. And then you're in the city, and then you're sort of changing. You're in your winter camp. But the difference, and I think one of my project partners, Timur, said it in a really good way, is like the living in the wilds and living in that nomadic lifestyle can be very fickle, but you make your own rules. You're your own boss. You're totally dependent on yourself, and you don't really have to answer to anyone. And that's like the freedom of it is kind of intoxicating. And when you think about these ancient nomads as well, they're like the kind of romantic, and some aspects of it are likely fantasy, but what I love about it is these, you know, their art, their way of life just kind of speaks of this immense freedom that I think that is pretty, you know, I think in our lives and, you know, in the post-industrial West, we're very locked into these life paths that seem very set in, and you don't have a lot of that control. And I think, you know, even more so now when you look at like a pandemic, it's like the quality of life you have in an urban center, and you know, it's difficult. I'd much rather be in a tent in Siberia right now.
What of this is something you want to share with the world, right? Of all this stuff that you're learning, of these viewpoint shifts, what of it are you in? What of it is like, well, this is a Trevor gift. This is a gift for Trevor. And then what of it is like, this is what I want to give to the world?
Yeah. I mean, for me, in the storytelling aspect of it, like, I want to ignite in people that like thrill of adventure and Indiana Jones, but I want to get to that piece of the deep cultural understanding, which is questioning modernity, really. Like, that's what, when you look into the past and really start to understand it and understand things like, you know, an ancient multi-ethnic culture that didn't follow any of the confines of the ideas of race that we have now, like, how does that change the way you think about race now? How does that thing change the way you think about culture and identity and whether you can make change? I mean, that's what I would love to communicate. Yeah, so I think in terms of like, since now I'm trying to get my documentary series off the ground, I have to think about things like, you know, markets and audience. And I'm thinking like, who is the audience for a lot of the work that I do? And lo and behold, you think about who's the audience of History Channel? It's like old white men. Who's the audience for a lot of, unfortunately, things about history are old white men, or, you know, white men that from culture. 35 to, yeah. And that's because history has such a Eurocentric lens. It has such this lens. And when I think about what I would love and I aspire to, I don't know, I hope to do, is to address this specific audience, because I think it's the audience of people who really need to change. They need to change their ideas about history, society, culture, ethics. So I think that there are many important, I think that I am uniquely able to tell that story because I am a white guy and they will listen to me. And I think that that's kind of ties into some of the things that you're seeing now, is like racial inequality, racial injustice. And then in this way, when you take it to a larger extent into history, it's a white people's issue. Like, this type of racism that we're seeing that's come, you know, that like is finally, a light is being shed on it. This needs to be framed as a white people's issue that we need to address and solve. And I think one piece of it, maybe it's a small piece, is addressing the way that we look at the past.
A lot of racism, it seems, is couched in sort of pop history and pop science.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a thing that needs to fall on scientists and historians to say, well, in fact, that's not true. Basically, your phrenology that you're touting as to why black and white people are different isn't true. And you seem to be saying, and let me know if I'm interpreting it incorrectly, but the sort of Hellenistic, like Eurocentric white people our great history view is not at all history of the world as it actually was.
Yes, 100%. And I think that it's ripe time to start looking into these parts of the map that have been, you know, essentially ignored, underfunded, looted. When you talk about the colonial enterprise and how it destroyed cultural heritage, and how in many ways we have only little fragments left in terms of the material culture. I was recently looking and sort of some of my personal research and investigations is in the illicit artifact trade. And you look at examples like the Benin Bronzes, which was a kingdom of actually Nigeria. In 1897, the British Empire stole 3,000 of these masterpieces, essentially, cultural, sacred, reliquary items that now are being sold by Sotheby's and Christie's. And these are, I mean, these are items that are going for over $2 million. Like, this is not chump change. And it's a really complex issue because you have kind of high society elite people, you know, usually European, American, white people who are saying, oh no, we're putting this on a level of fine art. Like, we're looking at these as art objects. When they are not simply just art objects, in my opinion, they are also sacred objects. They're also archaeological objects that we can get information from them that helps us understand where they came from and maybe where they should go back to. So I think that's incredibly important. So I think, like, you know, I think there was some saying of like, your calling is where, you know, your greatest passion meets the world's greatest need. And I think this has been my process of understanding what type of explorer I am, because there's not all good explorers. And I think it's a constant process of reinventing what that means for you and how it's going to manifest in your work. What kind of explorer do I want to be? What kind of exploration do I want to bring into the next generation? Who do I want to support? Who do I want to work with?
Wow. So we are getting close to an end point here. But before we go to plugs and how people can find you, because I very much want my audience to find your work, if you had maybe a piece of advice or something for people who are... A lot of us are stuck at home right now, or we are stuck in, even for after the pandemic ends, let's hope that that happens, and people are listening to this in the future, let's hope that there is one. It's not uncommon to feel stuck in a rut or stuck in a belief system or a viewpoint. From your work as an explorer, do you have any words of advice or encouragement for people who are dealing with that, the opposite of being an explorer, of feeling stuck, maybe a little bored, or like life has become rote?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think inspiration is like a muscle in your brain when you practice it. And like, when you practice it, it gets stronger. So the more that you can get excited about things that are not in front of you, or maybe not even a reality, because a lot of these things, like my expeditions to Siberia for many years, were just not realities. And I too, like, even now, I'm supposed to be in Siberia right now. I don't know if my expedition in the fall will be canceled or not. I was supposed to host an event with Jane Goodall, you know, our Explorers Gala in March. Like, we're all dealing with these massive disappointments. But it's that inner curiosity, inspiration that no one's going to give to you. But if you can tap into that some way and find a tool to acquire. Like, I think that actually, like, for me, editing the documentary film series, it's like quarantine has been very productive. The thing that I almost wish I had two quarantine lives for was learning Russian, because learning another language, I mean, I think, like, oftentimes when you travel as an English speaker, as a native English speaker, like, so many people around the world You can get by with English, but when you can speak another language, even sort of conversationally, it leads you in ways you just couldn't imagine. And I think that language communication, understanding other people's history, I can say for every single expedition I've done, like not waiting to learn when I'm there, but coming and being like, I remember I did my thesis film in Nepal, and I like had researched this bizarre archaic panchayat governmental system. So like when I interviewed scholars there, they're like, why do you even know about this? But they like loved it because it showed respect and that I was like dreaming of that one day and I had like envisioned it in my mind. And the books, the resources are out there. Like if you have the opportunity, you know, with internet access to tap into, you know, Duolingo and to be reading some bizarre, archaic, you know, scholarly articles about whatever your curiosity drives you to do, like the dreams can come into a reality, I think, you know, maybe not in the near future, but at some point.
Fuck yeah, man. I know I've been needing that. This week has really kicked my ass and taken out a lot of the inspiration from me, so that was much needed. Trevor Wallace, explorer filmmaker, where can my audience find your work?
Yeah, so I post pretty consistently on my Instagram, which is Worldwide Wallace. And I do, during quarantine times, I have been doing these live drawing sessions on Sundays because I love art as well. And I kind of mix it in with some archaeological topic and I use it to like investigate new cultures and new things I'm interested in. And you can ask me questions. For expedition opportunities, go to explorers.org. Like I said, I am the vice president of research and education, and I run our grant programs. We offer grants through Rolex, Fjällräven. We have high school, undergraduate, graduate, and postdoc grants. And we're currently launching a grant program with Discovery Channel, which are larger grants. So in total, we'll be giving away $1 million to expeditions around the world. And the pre-application is live. So if you go to explorers.org, there's a big banner at the top, and there's a frequently asked questions, and it's a new program, so we're still going through some of the growing pains, but it's a really exciting opportunity to get people out in the field.
Definitely, I have to say, Worldwide Wallace is a must follow. It makes my Instagram viewing 1,000 times more interesting. It's not just doom and gloom or weird Pokemon memes. So follow Worldwide Wallace if you can. As always, guys, I've been your host. My name is Alex Schiffman. You can follow me at AF Schiffman on Instagram. You can find this podcast wherever podcasts are dished out. If you happen to like this episode or any other, please send it to a friend. I don't really pay for marketing anywhere, so word of mouth is huge for me. So send this to somebody who might like it. Like and subscribe. You guys get the deal. Thank you for listening. I hope this made your quarantine just a little bit better. We're all in this together, and I will talk to you guys next time. Bye.